Hello, everyone, and welcome to Energy Security Cubed. I am your host, CEO and President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Kelly Ogle. On today's episode, recorded April 22nd, is the recording of our webinar, Natural Gas and North American Energy Security. Are Canada and the U.S. natural partners? This webinar is part of a series on American security challenges funded by the United States Department of State. Please note that the opinions, findings, and conclusions stated herein are those of the guest speaker and the moderator only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the United States Department of State. As I think most joining us today are aware, natural gas supply and transmission became the news cycle during the recent cold weather snap that engulfed the southern United States, more specifically Texas. Over the past several decades, North American natural gas supplies and distribution have become very integrated, and not just Canada and the United States, but Mexico as well. With me today, and I'm very excited to discuss this, are Tim Egan and Richard Meyer. Tim Egan is president and CEO of the Canadian Gas Association, the industry association representing the natural gas sector in Canada. Richard Meyer is vice president, energy markets analysis and standards at the American Gas Association, the industry association representing the natural gas sector in the United States. Tim and Richard, welcome.
Hey, Kelly. Nice to be here.
Glad to be here too.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to the discussion. I'm going to put the first question to both of you. Hopefully, I'm not taking you too much by surprise, but at the virtual Global Energy Summit today, both Trudeau and Biden set out massive aspirational goals / targets for greenhouse gas reduction. Please comment. And I'm going to go to Richard first, given that the summit's taking place virtually from DC.
Thanks, Kelly. And again, glad to be here today. The American Gas Association, we represent U.S. investor-owned natural gas utilities. These are the companies that deliver natural gas primarily to residential, commercial, and industrial end users, as well as some amount of power generation and transportation customers. So these are the 170 million Americans that use natural gas for their essential services every day. Kelly, looking at this climate pledge, let me start with what it is, at least from the U.S. perspective. I still have some work to digest it, but the Biden administration has announced a target for the United States to achieve a 50 to 52% reduction in economy-wide net greenhouse gas emissions by 2030, and that's relative to 2005 levels. Just kind of pulling some math together. If you take the trend that we're on from 2005 to 2019, that's about a 1.1% per year reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. That's based on the EPA inventory of greenhouse gases in the US. So 1.1% is the current trend. The Biden climate target would require a 2.7% per year pace of reduction. So that's about 2.5 times faster than the current pace. So this is an ambitious target, and the stated target will require contributions from all sectors of the economy. From AGA's perspective, the America's natural gas utilities will make a meaningful contribution to achieving this vision laid out by President Biden today, and will continue to drive down emissions in our nation and throughout the world. We can talk a little bit more about this, but the gas utility sector in the US and in Canada, with respect to our Canadian friends, we have a proven track record here of reducing emissions, both emissions directly associated with utilities, as well as the emissions associated with the energy delivered to customers. So there's a lot of work to do to continue on that trend, and AGA and U.S. gas utilities are ready to work with the administration to do what it takes to meet these climate targets.
Tim, as you know, I'm here in Calgary. It's snow. The sun isn't shining. The wind isn't blowing. And I just heard my furnace come on because it's 2 degrees and it's snowing heavily. Trudeau's goals are large, although not as large and and more as and less time constrained than Biden's, they're massive.
They are massive, Kelly. Thank you again for the opportunity to join you today. It's great to be here with Richard. We work really closely with the AGA on all kinds of issues because our industry is remarkably integrated across the continent. And on cold days like this, it's cold here in Toronto where I am also. We had a blanket of snow dropped yesterday and it's just above zero here. Cold days like this, the integration of the gas system is something we all appreciate because it's delivering heat to homes right across the continent. You suggested, Kelly, that the target that Mr. Biden set was bigger, and I guess, 50 to 52% is bigger than what our prime minister committed to this morning, which was 40 to 45% reductions against the same 2005 baseline by the 2030 Paris Accord target year. But the challenge, I think, is a bigger one in Canada. Richard said the decline in the U.S. has been about, Richard, if I heard you right, about 1.1% a year. Thus far, in Canada, our emissions from 2005 to 2019, and I'm quoting Environment Canada data, dropped a total of 1.1% over that 14-year period. So total of 1.1%. So to get to our current Paris target, the one that the Prime Minister committed us to in, when the Paris Accord meetings occurred, we have to find another roughly 29%, because that target again was 30% reductions against a 2005 baseline by 2030. So that means, if my math is right, that we have to increase the pace at which we're reducing emissions to meet our current target over 30 times. So 30 times as fast as we're going now, or more than 30 times as fast. Now, the Prime Minister said today 40 to 45%. The quote was he was going to blow past our target and get to 40 to 45% reductions. That means, again, I'm doing the math quickly here, that means that we have to increase the pace at which we reduce emissions to the point where we're reducing them at about 50 times as fast. Now, Kelly, the gas industry in Canada, like the gas industry in the United States, is going to do what it needs to do to be compliant with policy and legislative and regulatory frameworks. Nobody, frankly, has done more to reduce emissions than our industry has. The increase in efficiency of furnaces in Canada over the last 20 years has been the single largest reduction of emissions in the country, and we've driven it. We've driven a host of other energy efficiency initiatives that have done a ton to reduce emissions. But Kelly, I look at that pace and I say, wow, you got to increase it 35 to 50 times. That's a pretty daunting public policy target.
Well, I find it discouraging that it almost feels like, and I'm not as much blaming the Biden administration or Americans, but it seems like that, unfortunately, some of the public policy initiatives that have come out of the Trudeau government kind of consider hydrocarbon and more specifically natural gas as the problem, not the solution. And I'm just going to throw a couple of words out to you guys as we talk about natural gas in this transitional phase: resiliency and redundancy. All of the ideas and wonderful thoughts about reduction in emissions are interesting, but first of all, we need things like industry and consumers need a constant source of energy for their needs. And so could you discuss let's discuss transition and redundancy and resiliency. I'll let you lead, Tim.
Sure. So you said transition and resiliency and redundancy. And the term transition is not one that I like to use because it suggests that we've done something wrong and we need to change to do something right. And I'd argue that we've done things well and we're constantly improving them. And with new targets, we're going to need to increase the rate at which we change. But I don't see an energy future for our country that doesn't involve natural gas and its infrastructure. And I emphasize its infrastructure because if we're going to dramatically reduce emissions, we're going to need to be using things like hydrogen. And our industry in the US and Canada, we're at the forefront of technology innovation around the use of hydrogen. And the largest single source of hydrogen across the continent is very likely to be natural gas. Hydrogen is a gas, means the best way to move it is through pipes. So the infrastructure that we have is probably the best way to move it. So when you talk, the word you use is transition, I'll talk about a continuing evolution of the industry to a lower emission future. And I'll say that I think natural gas is fundamental to achieving it, be it through alternative fuels like hydrogen or like renewable natural gas, or be it through supporting other technologies like electric technology using wind and solar, which is fundamentally dependent on fuels like natural gas to provide the backup, because wind and solar are intermittent technologies and they need technologies that are going all the time. They need fuels that are available all the time, and natural gas is a necessary partner to them. And that takes me to your question about redundancy and resiliency. And I'll let Richard talk about Texas, but watching it from afar, or watching what happened in California, or watching what happened in Australia a couple of years ago, or what's happened in various markets around the world, if you don't have the reliability of your energy system forefront in your planning, if you aren't thinking all the time about, okay, what if this happens? If you're not building in redundancy to accommodate that, if you're not building a system that's as resilient as you possibly can, you're exposing your customers to pretty significant risk. And the worst case scenario of that risk is the kind of situation we just saw in Texas. And if people don't have access to energy in severe cold, in severe weather events, people suffer often horrifically. And a point we make again and again about the whole conversation around energy and environment is, think about energy delivery systems. And we really have three big ones. We have a liquid fuels delivery system. So that's your gasoline and your diesel, and it's coming by truck and by boat and other means. And that's to service your liquid fuel needs. We have an electric delivery system, and that's electrons coming over wires. And we have a gaseous system, and that's energy coming through pipes. One of the great strengths we have in North America is that we have all three systems, and they're really robust. And if there's a problem with one, the others can provide a kind of backup. And we want that. And so in any energy and environment conversation, you want to make sure that you're not losing sight of the importance of having all those delivery systems. And my worry in the current conversation is that an idea is taking hold that, no, you can be completely, you can put everything on one system. And we in the gas industry are seeing that more and more with talk about, getting off of the use of gas infrastructure. And we want to emphasize the point that that's a really, really dangerous direction to take our society because of the kind of risks that it exposes us to. And Texas is an example.
Richard, I led that question on purpose because part of the discussion I wanted today is about what happened in the midwinter there in Texas. And, there were a multitude of variables, some controllable, some uncontrollable, but they perfectly aligned to cause massive supply disruptions. You've reported broadly on this, and we've talked about it before. Could you give us a Coles Notes synopsis of what happened? And again, using the words redundancy and resiliency, I think can help sum up the evidence that of what happened and what's to happen in the future, possibly.
Yeah, let me. I want to just build on something Tim said, and let me
certainly pivot, absolutely that's the purpose
pivot here. To the to your question about what happened in Texas. They are interrelated. Tim used the word we use the word transition. I too don't think that that's the right word. It emphasizes a mental model that I think is not correct.
I'm not a fan of the word either.
Fair enough. I think the word I like evolution. I also like the word transformation in a way, and that evolution can lead to a transformation over different time periods. We've seen the energy system in North America and in the U.S. transform before. We've seen the natural gas system transform, and it will again. But underlying that transformation is a need for investments. And we need to make investments today to ensure that we are delivering affordable natural gas safely, reliably, efficiently, and to ensure an overall resilient energy system. And while it may seem counterintuitive, the investing more in our domestic natural gas pipeline network helps us reach our climate goals more quickly, more effectively, precisely for what the reasons Tim just illustrated. We have an electricity network and a fuels network and a gaseous fuels network, and they are interrelated. They support each other. And that's true today, and it will be true in the future, even as we reduce greenhouse gas emissions and move along pathways to a significantly lower carbon energy economy. So just, I agree with everything Tim said. I just wanted to build a couple of those pieces out, maybe pull in some of those threads, because I thought they were really important to emphasize here. As we think about the energy system and how it supports us, and how we deliver those essential fuels on the coldest days of the year, let's look at some of the facts that emerged out of this recent cold event in February. It was across North America. A lot of unfortunate aspects of this event played out in Texas. What we saw, just a couple observations here. One, local distribution companies that deliver natural gas continued to provide safe and reliable service to customers with few interruptions during this event. And this is true even in the southern US, where a lot of these kind of overall energy disruptions took place. US natural gas consumption set a record during this period. It was actually a two-day record over February 14th and February 15th. Texas natural gas demand set an all-time record. Spikes in natural gas use in the power sector and for buildings and in industry. So even despite the kind of disruptions on the electric grid, the Texas power generation sector consumed more natural gas than ever before. We were talking about integration of the North American energy system. Really important piece here. We saw a lot of demand and supply flexibility during this time. And the cold temperatures had the effect of increasing U.S. imports of natural gas, pipeline natural gas from Canada. Flows were about 3.6 billion cubic feet per day before the event. Those increased to about 8.4 BCF per day right after, during the peak of the cold event. So, more than doubled. That supply flexibility, those imports from Canada, helped balance the U.S. natural gas system on those days that customers need this energy most. And there's a lot more we can talk about in terms of how supply and demand changed. There were the challenges to the electric grid reliability, obviously very important and impactful to people. I don't want to minimize the human impact during this period. It was significant, but in terms of the market, there's a lot that worked here, and a lot that didn't, and we need to kind of pull that apart. And I would just kind of, I'll end by noting that we still have more to learn here. A final root cause analysis of what took place during February is still to come. So I think we have some lessons we can derive today, and there'll still be lessons to learn from there. I'll stop there, and we can continue if any of those pieces are.
Yeah, I don't want to go too deep into the weeds, but it pleases me to hear you talk about that. I didn't realize that it almost tripled imports from Canada because of that ability to the not only redundancy but resiliency and ability from companies like the Northern Border Pipeline System to supply gas to Texas or California if it need be, or Northeast United States. That's the integration, and that's really from an existential energy security perspective, that's what we're here to talk about, fellas. So let's continue that. I don't want to go into the electric market and ERCOT and the things that happened in Texas. That's not part of the discussion today, because they were certainly the effect, not the cause, and provided issues. But let's talk more about this integrated natural gas system. We're the two largest bilateral trading nations in the world, and gas is part of that. Tim, what, you know, give us a little overview about how you and Richard, for instance, work together on representing your customers and your and the beneficiaries of great natural gas supply and demand coexistence in Canada and the United States and Mexico, if you choose to, please.
Sure. Well, you know, at very high level, a couple things to note. As you noted, Kelly, we're two of the largest gas producers in the world. Canada used to be a particularly critical supplier of natural gas to the United States, but the economic recovery of significant new gas supplies in the U.S., in the Northeast and in Texas and elsewhere has made the U.S. Well, I think right now they're the large, are they, Rich will tell you, if they're the largest single supplier in the world, but producer in the world, but certainly one of the largest. And but the integration between the two remains critically important. We have pipeline connections across the country, moving gas both ways. And it's moving gas both ways because the regional markets across the continent and supply flows meet the needs of those regional markets. So you've got that kind of flow integration. So you've got two strong supplier countries with regional markets across the continent working together cooperatively. It's a remarkably seamless energy system across the two countries. I often say that one of our great successes in the gas industry can almost be a detriment to us, and that's that it's always working. So people don't think about it because it's always working, and they don't realize how much energy is moving back and forth and what that's doing to deliver that affordable energy to keep industry going, to keep commerce going, to keep people living comfortable lives in their homes and so on. So all of that is occurring. In addition though, Kelly, there's a lot of integration in terms of the companies. So two of the largest infrastructure companies in North America are Canadian companies, Enbridge and TC Energy. And they're significant asset holders in Canada, in the United States. In the case of TC Energy, a significant player in Mexico. And in fact, TC Energy has been instrumental in building the U.S.-Mexico natural gas relationship. And so what you have is, in addition to just the supply picture and the flows that are occurring, you have the infrastructure over which that's occurring, which is infrastructure owned by major companies that are often Canadian-based. Our memberships also overlap. We've got a number of utilities in the U.S. owned by Canadian companies and vice versa. There's significant investment in the Canadian industry. So you've got some pretty terrific integration of the industry. Between our associations, we work together on a whole host of things reflecting that level of integration. We work on operational issues, on safety issues, we're doing a ton of work around innovation, sharing notes on new innovative technologies that are coming forward. We do work on cybersecurity. We work on a whole range of things together, and it's a very positive relationship, and it's one that is. And I don't mean to speak for Richard, but from CJ's perspective, it's worked incredibly well for us, and I hope it has for our American friends as well.
So take it away, Richard, with those very comments. I can't overstate how much I agree with that.
I agree with what Tim said. He was speaking for me insofar that the collaboration the natural gas industry in the U.S. has with Canada is very integrated. The companies are integrated. We support each other, and the association engagement between the Canadian Gas Association and the American Gas Association has been very productive and fruitful. Maybe I'll add just one piece of this. We were talking about the transition or transformation of energy systems, and Tim did touch on this in terms of this evolving energy innovation agenda. I know our team at AGA has benefited a lot from our collaboration with the experts at CGA, learning about your learning about the Canadian lessons, thinking through hydrogen opportunities, thinking through the opportunities to innovate new end-use gas technologies, the research and development agendas that have evolved in Canada are very applicable for the U.S. and meeting our affordability, energy reliability and resilience goals, as well as our climate change challenge. So this is a long way around the barn of suggesting that everything Tim said, I agree with, and that collaboration can and should continue. It's been, as I said, it's been productive and very fruitful.
So I guess that leads me to ask, and I'll just rant for a minute about infrastructure. You know, when TC Energy got, when the Keystone XL was quashed by executive order by Biden, they were at the point where they were prepared to power that whole unit with renewable energy. I got to think that we need more gas infrastructure. A lot of these build outs by the governments after the coming out of the pandemic involved necessary increases in infrastructure. Would you both like to comment on where we're going on the continent with infrastructure build out, more specifically the gas systems, including Mexico? I'm not familiar with that many new projects, and I got to think that, you know, they will be as net, you know, I don't like these terms like net zero and credits and all that. It seems to me like a bit of a shell game. That's just my own opinion. But we have infrastructure challenges, and where are they? What are we looking at in the gas system, Tim, from the perspective of the future of new infrastructure?
Well, as you said, we have infrastructure challenges. The challenges are not on the performance of the infrastructure. I'd say the infrastructure in North America is state of the art. And we've got good regimes in place in jurisdictions, you know, at the state level in the US, provincial level in Canada, for excellent regulatory oversight and steady upgrading of the quality of infrastructure. And it really is state of the art. There is, to underscore Richard's earlier point, a need for new investment in order to meet the targets that are being set. The new investment is not about making sure their infrastructure is sound. It is sound. It can meet our current needs, but there's, like any infrastructure, you're constantly working to improve it. And that culture is in place, that process in place. The challenge is, if you want these new targets met, you're going to need to significantly invest in order to be able to deliver on them. So I'd say that that's kind of the policy and economic challenge around infrastructure. There's another challenge, which is political. And Kelly, you were alluding to that with reference to some projects that have had particular challenges. For the most part, on the gas side, we have not had challenges building new infrastructure. And I think it's a credit to our members. Remember, our members are companies that have millions and millions of customers. Richard talked about, I think it's over 70 million customers in the US.
Right.
And you know, we have, it's always kind of a 1-to-10 relationship, right? We have over 7 million customers in Canada, and these customers are homes and commercial institutions and industrial facilities that are using our energy day in, day out. And so that means we're in communities. Our infrastructure is everywhere in communities across the country. And so when we're building it, we're engaging with those communities, and we're making sure those communities understand the infrastructure, are happy with the infrastructure, understand the safety provisions we have in place, understand the operational protocols and so on. And I think we've done that very, very well. But the emerging political challenge is opposition to infrastructure. I think it applies across the board. It's pretty difficult to build any new infrastructure of any kind in North America today because of public objection to the idea of large physical plant. And that's something that we're working through. It's aggravated in the case of our infrastructure because we're moving hydrocarbons through it, and there's growing opposition to the idea of hydrocarbon infrastructure. And look, I think we make the case very well for why this infrastructure actually is critical to meeting the emission targets that people are setting, and we've spoken about that already. But let's face it, that's that's a real challenge we've got right now, to continue to face up to that and to make sure that the discussions that are occurring based on facts, that people actually understand, okay, what does this infrastructure do? How does it address environmental concerns? How does it address reliability and resiliency concerns? How does it ensure that energy continues to be affordable so that our societies can continue to advance? All of these things are critical to that. And that's the big political challenge we have, engaging in that conversation.
You know, it's the public policy steps that are going to, you know, that are the, I'm not going to say stumbling blocks, but they're certainly pivot points that we have to encounter. But Tim and Richard, thanks again so much. So, this has been, I think, very, very enlightening for people that took the time to listen and to get a better understanding of where the gas system fits in North American energy security. Thanks again. Thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of Energy Security Cubed. You can find the CGI Network on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Play. If you like the show, give us a rating. You can also support us by donating at cgai.ca/support. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Energy Security Cubed is brought to you by our team at CGI. Thanks go out to our producer, Seth Scott, and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Kelly Ogle. Thanks for joining us on Energy Security Cubed.